This podcast is brought to you by On Track Studio.
This podcast addresses various mental health challenges, including topics such as suicide, addiction, eating disorders, depression, and anxiety. These discussions may be triggering for some individuals. If you or someone you know is struggling, please seek support from a mental health professional or a trusted individual in your life. Remember, you are not alone and help is available. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Mind Your Head. Today's guest is none other than Andy Herndon, or universally known online as Andy Cooks, with 20 years experience working in kitchens all around the world. So when COVID hit and shut down the hospitality industry, Andy saw an opportunity online to inspire people in the kitchen, to help them become better home cooks, to give them the confidence to try something new, and most importantly, have fun. Now Andy Cooks has a combined 13 million followers on YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram, with over 2 billion views, perhaps the most talked about chef at the moment. He was nominated for Australian TikTok Creator of the Year and also won Australian YouTube Creator of the Year. Some would say he's the hottest thing in the kitchen right now. I can't wait for you all to listen to this episode. Now let's get stuck in. Andy, welcome to Mind Your Head. It's a real pleasure to have you on today.
Thanks for having me, mate.
This is a little bit of a pinch myself moment. I think I mentioned to you earlier that I started this, almost just over a year ago now. Yeah. And your name was at the top of the list.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it is a sort of a big moment for me. So, yeah, again, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
It's fair to say that your life has changed a great deal over the last 2 to 3 years, and it may even surpass sort of your wildest dreams of what could be possible. Can you pinpoint a time in your life, maybe in your childhood, where this drive for success started? And what was the drive initially? Was it to be successful? Was it to be the best you can be? Was it just a pure love of food? And yeah, when did it begin for you?
My biggest fear in life is failure, I think. Mm. So I've always just gone really hard at things. And I've always known I was going to be always kind of, it sounds really arrogant, but always been like, oh, I'm going to do something kind of.
Yeah.
Big, I guess, in my, because big can mean a lot of things to a lot of people.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, but, you know, and it probably went dormant for a while and, you know, got into a corporate career and that was going really well. Mm. And then COVID kicked it off and it was like, all right, I've got to do something for myself now. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty wild. And I know you've probably been asked this question a fair bit. And I'm asking this because I spent a bit of time in New Zealand playing rugby and all my family are from New Zealand. And while I was there, every kid that I met, all they wanted to do was play for the All Blacks. You know, that's all. It's crazy. Like, they've got storybooks of like the All Blacks and that's their heroes and stuff. Yeah. So was being a chef always your dream, or was there a dream to play for the All Blacks when you were?
There was no rugby in my dream set. Yeah. No, it was always cooking and being successful. But yeah, I think I'm the youngest of 4 and 3 boys.
Yeah.
And my brothers were very much, you know, the traditional Kiwi blokes that wanted to play footy or rugby, I should say. And I just never kind of went down that path. I always went opposite to it, I think, out of spite.
Yeah, trying to be a bit of a rebel or something. Yeah.
So I was always into riding bikes and things like that and never played kind of, wasn't really into team sports, which maybe now thinking about it says something.
Yeah. So what was home life for you? Like, obviously, you're from New Zealand. Whereabouts did you grow up? And what did sort of food play a role in your upbringing?
Yeah, so I grew up in Wellington to a single mum. You know, had 4 kids, and her family were all poultry farmers about an hour north of Wellington in a place called Foxton.
Yeah.
So, you know, food was really important in our upbringing. Mum did a great job to put food on the table. You know, twice a day we ate as a family, or breakfast and dinner, and there was always like, you know, home cooking and home baking and stuff for lunch.
But
food-wise was very basic. It was, you know, New Zealand and Australia back then, and I was born in 85, so in the 80s and early 90s, it was pretty average. Like, it was meat and 3 veg.
Yeah, roast potatoes.
Yeah, it didn't change much.
Yeah, good gravy.
Yeah, good gravy, But good home baking.
Yeah.
But I was obsessed with food from a very young age, always. Like, mum's got photos of me playing with plastic food. And
really?
Yeah, you know, like, I was like the only boy that had the toy kitchen. And,
boy.
Yeah. And then just was always upset, always said, you know, as a kid, I'll be a chef.
Looking back on it now, did you feel quite lucky having that dream from the very start and then not deviating? Like, I know sort of my experience, it's sort of gone different avenues and I've tried new things and trying to find sort of my groove in life. Do you feel quite lucky that you just had a set goal of what you wanted to do and you've achieved it?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I probably realized that a long time ago. Like, you know, as soon as I like could get out of high school, I got out of high school and went and pursued this, and I kind of saw all my mates do exactly what you just talked about and kind of, you know, fumble their way through life. You know, some successfully in one career, some not, you know, and I, from as early as I kind of can remember, it was just cooking.
Go. Yeah. So you did you drop out of school, did you?
Yeah. I couldn't wait to get out of school. I was terrible in school.
Same.
I'm really dyslexic. I struggle with written language.
Oh, still.
I mean, I can read and write, but like it doesn't come naturally to me. So I couldn't wait to get out of school. Day I was 16, I was out of there.
See you later. Straight to chef school, is that
Straight to chef school.
Yeah. So how long is chef school, is it?
It's kind of a bit different in New Zealand. I did 1 year kind of intensive. I didn't do like an apprenticeship. So I went full time into chef's college for a year, and then you're out in the big bad world.
Where was your so was that in Auckland, was it your chef school? And then where did you find yourself out of chef school? Where did you land?
I went into a little neighborhood restaurant, didn't last long there. Then I kind of went into the cafe scene, which, you know, in Australia and New Zealand, cafe scene was, you know, really good back then.
Almost brutal, isn't it?
It's so fast paced. But I wanted to get to Europe. That was kind of my goal. So
Is that everyone's sort of goal as a chef, to get over to Europe? Is that the destination to sort of learn and...
Yeah, it definitely was back then. You know, I think it's probably changed a bit now. You know, the gastronomic scene in this part of the world now is just as good as it is anywhere else in the world. But back then it was like, you need to get to either US or Europe. But it was really Europe that everyone wanted to go to.
Yeah, exactly. And what was your mindset sort of arriving in? And was it London that you arrived in? Yeah, what was your mindset arriving there? Was it just to learn as much as you can and with the best sort of people?
Exactly. Yeah, it was just... just kind of see where it took me and discover who I was as a chef, which is pretty important. Like a lot of vocations, there's not one type of chef, you know. So you kind of want to dip your toes in all and fine dining, and you know the more more kind of brasserie style food and everything. And it was kind of a bit of travel as well. I was still pretty young and pretty keen to kind of see the world and
bit of adventure and have some fun and stuff. Cool. So what key individuals or venues did you land in London that sort of shaped you as a chef?
So my first job in London was with a guy called Tom Atkins, who's a pretty formidable chef, shall we say. He's got a name for himself.
I read a little bit about him.
And I kind of didn't work directly with Tom. I mainly worked with his brother Rob, but they like Kiwis and Aussies.
They do.
Because you know we know how to work hard. Yeah. I think a lot of the the European, you know, kids are quite hardworking. And I think they were just, you know, keen. Well, we're just keen to get there and have a crack.
Have a go.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's also the qualities that you learnt, you know, sort of growing up on the farm, the poultry farm and stuff, sort of put you in good stead for this career.
Absolutely. My grandfather was the hardest working person I've ever met. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. It's just, you know.
He would have kept working, wouldn't he?
The whole time.
The whole time.
He never stopped.
There's a really good quote that I heard, and it's to do with the cooking industry, is to take it professionally, not personally.
Yeah.
And I think like having thick skin is such a key attribute to being a chef. And I was watching Gordon Ramsay, and it's like when he holds up the two bits of bread.
Yeah.
He
calls it an idiot sandwich.
Is that the type of sort of environment that it's in over there, in the kitchens?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to describe that because people probably think that you're over-exaggerating when you talk about some of the stories, but they are, you know, it's genuinely really brutal. It's really militant. There's a lot of, and it's definitely changed now, but back then there was a lot of bullying, you know, and some people reacted really well to it and some people didn't. Yeah. And I'm not saying that that's the right way to go about things.
Yeah.
But for someone like myself, I actually responded well to it. Yeah. I needed that discipline.
Did you? Yeah. So I feel something similar because I left school to join the army.
Yeah.
And reading sort of how the environment was in the kitchens, I can sort of relate to just getting yelled at when I was 17 years old to get out of bed at 4 a.m. And like at that age and where I was in my life, like you, I responded really well to that. Yeah. I liked having discipline and being told what to do, because if you leave it up to me, I
I've got a bit of a lazy attitude, really, like if you leave it up to me. But if someone's pounding me and sort of like getting up my ass, it sort of motivates me to do it. So,
yeah. It's all kitchens like that. They're all about precision, timing, you know, all that stuff that's really hard for an early 20-year-old to grasp. Right. So you've got to make sure that you get shit done properly, quickly, efficiently, and on time. So.
Well, you mentioned that you're 21. Did it mature you at a young age?
Yeah. I think I naturally was a pretty mature for my age because I left school pretty early and I was, you know, straight into kitchens with, you know, guys in their early to mid 20s. As a teenager, you have to go up pretty quickly, for better or worse.
Yeah. How difficult was it trying to discover yourself as a chef, but also who you are as a person at that time in your life and being so young and being in that environment?
Yeah, I don't think it's something that I ever thought about, honestly. Like, I was using a lot of alcohol and drugs, working really hard and partying really hard. So it's honestly just a blur at that point. It was just survival. And I didn't think very methodically or deeply about who I was as a person or anything. It wasn't until, you know, I cleaned myself up and sorted my life out.
That you
start thinking about that stuff.
So what was the progress in London? Did you sort of work your way up, did you?
Yeah. So started in as a shifter party and then worked my way up to a head chef role, through the ranks, you know, shifter party, junior sous chef, sous chef, senior sous chef, head chef, executive chef.
How did you cope being a head chef?
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I had my first head chef job when I was 27 and I think I was too young.
Yeah.
I hadn't quite understand the responsibility of managing people. Mm. You know, I think I was, you know, able to do the job from a culinary perspective, but you know, a head chef's job is like a lot of senior management roles are actually more about managing people than they are about creating food.
Cooking, yeah. Did you have any mentors or role models like that? Tom Atkins, was he a chef that you kind of thought, that's who I want to be? Or,
well, I think I started like that and I started just, you know, imitating behavior and pretty quickly learned that wasn't a smart idea. And I'm not an aggressive asshole by nature. So, you know, when you try and...
To be that,
it doesn't work. Mm. So, but that was the only way that I knew how to manage because that's the only way I'd seen. But it's interesting, a lot of senior management roles don't often get training, especially in, you know, unless you're working in big corporates with, you know, and you've done a career for 40 years or something. Mm. But if you're like a site foreman or, you know, some of these kind of roles... All of a sudden, you're managing 5, 10, 15, 20 people. Yeah. You've never had training on how to manage anyone. Yeah. It's crazy.
It's funny because I had a conversation at work out in the mines because when you sort of become a supervisor out there, that's your name's a supervisor, and then you have to manage 20 or 30 people. Mm. But there's no training. Like that, they're not on the gear anymore. They're not operating anything. No. All their job is to make sure each person is doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And you could just see, like, end of the day, you could just see the supervisors. It's just like, there you go, mate. Like, I need a beer. Yeah. Like, I need a fucking beer. I'm done. Yeah. I'm done. So I completely understand that. And I've talked to my supervisors about it. I think you guys need to do a bit of either stress training or, like, leadership training to know how to, like, control a group of people.
Yeah.
How did you handle the stress and pressure?
Well, like I just kind of alluded to, I was just, you know, drinking and every night and doing drugs and stuff. So,
yeah.
And I think that's the only way I got through it. It was just, you know, really intense long hours.
Yeah.
And then you just relax by, you know, abusing substances and then go back and do it the next day.
Do you think you thrive in high-pressure situations, though?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I work the best, even now, when I've got 15 things on the go and, you know, and I don't have time to think. And I love it.
You love it?
I love it.
You do?
Yeah. But everyone's like, oh, slow down. I'm like, no.
I'm in my element right now. So my next question was, did you ever think this was too much? Did you ever think that, like, you felt like quitting?
No, I've never felt like
that. Yeah, I didn't think you did. No. You loved it too much.
Yeah.
Even at its height of sort of stressful situations.
Well, the cooking, I mean, maybe I did think about quitting, but in a different way. I always thought I need an exit plan from working in the kitchen every day.
Oh, okay.
Very similar to how guys that are operating machines in the mines every day, right? You're like, well, how do I get out of this? Because it's really physical and really long hours. So I kind of went the direction at the start of getting into the corporate hospitality world, you know, so and then figured out a way of being a, you know, corporate executive chef and managed, you know, hundreds of venues and so it's a very different type of stress, though. It's still a very stressful job,
yeah,
if not more stressful,
yeah,
but you're not on the day-to-day grind of
working in the past or something.
Working a section.
Well, what qualities do you think you need to excel at a chef?
I think you just need resilience. And a willingness. You need to love it, right? Like, it's like a lot of things. You need to actually enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it, then
it's like you got to fall in love with the hard stuff.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
And the stuff that you don't like doing, you need to teach yourself to like doing it, or just change your mindset to think that you're enjoying it.
I don't have to do it. I get to do it.
Yeah.
Did you see a lot of chefs quit?
Yep. Yeah, I've seen a lot of chefs quit, and a lot quit in really dramatic ways, you know.
Like what?
Just in the middle of service, you know, like just walk, like, you know, swearing and throwing aprons down to see a lady. Never
really?
See them again. Yeah.
Like you said, that environment of that sort of military tile, sort of yelling and that sort of thing. Does it need to be like that for it to be successful?
No, not at all. And a lot of the top restaurants now are not like
that.
No. I think it's definitely changed from, you know, I think I was probably the last generation of chefs that saw it from the early days, you know, to what it was. And then it kind of, people kind of latched on to, again, back to that, you know, people learnt how to be leaders and properly, you know, mentor people as opposed to just scream at them.
So how did you learn, like, when you became a head chef, how did sort of you learn not to do things or do things a different way?
Just by failing.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. So you know, you go and you start managing a certain way, and then no one shows up.
Oh, right.
You kind of just go, stuff that up and take a step back or go, you know, I kind of took a demotion at one point and it was like, oh, I couldn't, you know, really struggling to do this. All right, I need to go back and relearn how to do this and then work your way back up again.
Yeah. Have you always been really good at managing failure?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not scared to fail.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also a believer, and I hate the saying, or, you know, when people say, like, don't never quit, you know, like, I'm not a fan of that. Okay. And I think people need to learn to know when to quit. I think that's the difference.
It's like what would my dad say? It's the difference between giving up and quitting.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you've got to know the difference. Yeah.
You've got to know the difference. If you're flogging something for ages and it's not working, then it might not be right for you.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Just move on. Yeah.
What do you think is the pinnacle of a chef? I've always wanted to know. Is it to be a sort of a head chef at a fine dining restaurant? Is that like?
I think for some,
yeah. Okay.
Not for all, but yeah, for a lot.
For you,
At one point, but not forever.
Yeah,
no.
Too much.
Yeah, I just think it's more so about the style of food, right? So you kind of learn how your style of food, and my style of food is very much not that. It's not fine dining. I don't enjoy cooking it.
Yeah,
I enjoy cooking, you know, kind of family style meals, you know, that are spread out on a table and everyone kind of tucks in and enjoys. I don't enjoy, you know, very
the little fine details.
And I'm happy to go and go to those restaurants, you know, every now and then. Mm. It's also not something that I kind of strive for.
Yeah,
yeah.
How long was your journey in London? Was it
almost 7 years in London?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so a long time. I have got an English passport, so I didn't have to stress about that.
You're local.
Yeah, I was local.
Did you manage to travel while you were over there?
Yeah.
Did you get around? Where'd you go?
You know, pretty much all over Europe, you know.
Did you?
Yeah. It was so cheap, and anytime you had some time off, you'd just jump on
$50 or something, £50.
£50, £20 flight and go somewhere.
Overall, what were your sort of biggest takeaways and learnings from your time in London?
I always say I learned how to cook in London. You know,
like
I went to chef school when I went, and I did a couple of years of working in New Zealand. But, you know, I really learned how to cook in London and, you know, how to cook proper food, how to manage a kitchen, and how to mentor people.
Yeah. So that was a really crucial part in your development.
Yes, hugely crucial.
Yeah.
And I guess I only left just because, you know, London's one of those places that can kind of it's just all encompassing.
Yeah, it can be a little bit miserable sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, New Zealand weather's not the greatest, is it?
It's a bit better than
It's a bit better. So you left London.
Yeah.
Where did you go back to?
Went to Sydney. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
I couldn't bear to go back to New Zealand at that point.
You couldn't go back?
No. I wanted to be closer. I wanted to be at this part of the world, but I didn't really want to go to New Zealand. So,
yeah.
Landed in Sydney. Worked at a restaurant called Felix for a while, but didn't love Sydney at that time. Didn't.
What year was that when you got there?
Oh, good question. Oh, I'm guessing 2012.
Oh, maybe right. A bit earlier. Yeah. The food scene wasn't going off then.
No. Sydney was a funny place back then, I thought. It was pretty flashy and didn't have much soul. It was, you know, lots of big fancy restaurants, but it was kind of a place that you go out and to be seen as opposed to the food.
The food. And it is a bit hard coming from Europe and London
and then
their food scene over there, then coming back to Australia and going, is this it?
But, you know, and just a caveat that Sydney's food scene now has changed and it's very good.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We'll put that in.
Yeah.
We don't hate Sydney. Sydney's fine. So how long were you in Sydney for?
Not even a year. Maybe 10, 11 months and I moved to Melbourne.
Did you have a chance to go back to New Zealand and see the family or anything?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, cool.
Back and forth.
Nice.
Yeah, it's not that far.
Yeah. All my family are over there and I still hardly see them. So you got to Melbourne and actually I got some cousins that live in Melbourne and I think I put up a photo of me and you doing the book signing and my cousin messaged me saying, oh, Andy used to come into our butcher to get meat. So they own Hagen Meats.
Oh, yeah. It's a great shop.
Yeah. So my cousin Ollie, he was like, tell him I said hello. I'm like, will he remember you? He's like, nah, probably not. So you got to Melbourne and what were you doing? What restaurants were you at?
Started at a restaurant called Gill's Diner.
Yep.
Was there for a while. It was a great little kind of city-based bistro. That place got bought by some Italian guys who kind of changed an Italian restaurant. So I moved on, opened up Entrecote in the city kind of pretty briefly. And then I took up a role as the executive chef of the St. Ali Group, which is they're a coffee roaster, but they have a lot of cafes as well. So,
oh, nice.
And I was there for a few years.
Yeah. And you mentioned before sort of you handling, your ways of handling stress and pressure was obviously when you're young, I did the same thing, was a lot of drugs and alcohol. Was there ever a time when your own mental health needed some attention?
No. I think the mental health one's funny for me. I think the only issue I've ever struggled with mental health is addiction. Mm. I don't think I've ever been, you know, struggled with depression or anxiety, which I feel blessed through because there's a big history of it in my family. My mum really struggles with it and my grandmother did and, you know, there's a, you know, huge kind of history of it in my family. So, it wasn't until the, you know, that realization that I've got an issue with addiction here, that's when I was like, oh, well, this is mental health as well. But
yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Do you mind sharing what your addiction was?
At the end, it was just straight alcohol.
Was it? Yeah.
I mean, I smoked weed my whole time, but the booze is what got me.
Yeah. And just drawing from my own experiences of addiction, like it wasn't so much alcohol. I'd never been a good drinker.
Yeah.
But like when I was sort of playing footy, that was my escape. I couldn't handle the anxiety and sort of pressure of playing rugby. And as soon as I finished, that was sort of my release.
Yeah.
Was it a release for you? Why were you drinking?
Yeah, it was just, you know, that kind of that feeling of, you know, the first beer or the first glass of wine or whatever, and you're just instantly relaxed, aren't you?
So, yeah, it is.
And then it's just, you know, I think people underestimate how powerful of a drug alcohol is. And then it's like, so it's every day, you know, every day after work, and then it's like every day halfway through the day, and then before you know it, you're like,
I need it. Yeah.
You start getting the shakes at a certain point.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's like more often than not, like we're the sort of the last ones to realize that this is a issue.
Yeah.
Was there a pivotal moment for you that you're suddenly aware that I need to seek help?
Yeah. Well, maybe not. I think there was a realization probably 2 or 3 years before I gave it up that it wasn't sustainable what I was doing. From a, you know, it's like you just kind of start doing the maths about how many standard drinks you're having a day, and it's like, I can't do this forever, right? Like the science is pretty black and white about that. And then there was a point where it was like, you know, I think it just kind of let, it was that, then it was always on my mind. And eventually it was like, I got to do, let's go. Like,
yeah. And this might be a bit of a tricky question to answer, but do you think the lifestyle of a chef, especially in such a cutthroat industry, can it be prone to challenges with their mental health? And
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and drug and alcohol abuse, you know, like you're just exposed to it, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
You know, all the drug dealers in London with just in the restaurants and, you just had access to it really easily.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's high stress, you know, you finish service and it's midnight or whatever. you know, you're wound up, you're excited, your adrenaline's pumping, so you just search for something to kind of help ease that so you can, you know, get to bed.
And how was your rehab stint, was it?
It was, so I was drinking so much they had to kind of wean me off it effectively. So they, I did a 30-day rehab stint, but I did 2 weeks before to sober me up. So I got taken into a private house and two full-time psych nurses kind of weaned me off the booze over 2 weeks.
Yeah, wow. Like,
you know, filling me up with antidepressants and basically knocked me out. And then they monitor you, making sure that your blood pressure and stuff's all right for 2 weeks, and then just kind of ease you off that, whatever they used a ton of drugs.
Brutal.
Yeah.
After you got out, were you able to slip straight back into work? How did?
Pretty much. Yeah. I think I was really lucky because for me, you know, that I discovered that myself. You know, it was like, I want to get sober. I'm done. I'm over this. Mm. I actually left rehab, got on a plane to New Zealand, went to my best mate's wedding, right? And there's a lot of people that are like, this is not a great idea. Because I'm not missing his wedding, right? Like,
but you can't drink.
But yeah, but you can't drink.
But,
and I've never looked back. I've never...
Amazing.
Not interested. Doesn't
not regretted it once, yeah. No,
doesn't
yeah.
bother me, yeah.
How I like to cook, I wouldn't be able to last in a restaurant at all. not the way I like to cook. I think cooking is one of the most zen things you can do. Like when I cook, it's... I'm so focused and on this one thing, just trying to be the best I can at this one thing. Like nothing else matters. You can't sort of afford to be thinking about anything else. Yeah. How has cooking now sort of changed since your time in rehab? And has it changed your outlook on food or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, no, I think my outlook on food's always been pretty solid. I think I'm a big fan of the saying, knowledge makes you stupid. So, and I think about that a lot. Because effectively what we do now is try and educate and inspire people to cook better food at home. Mm. So what's really second nature to me is not second nature to most people.
Yes.
So when I cook, it's like literally autopilot, I don't think. It's just
really?
Just go. It just happens.
Right? Muscle memory.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can whip up all these nice dishes then without even trying?
Pretty much, yeah. yeah. So if it's something I've never cooked before, there might be a little bit of research as to just understanding certain ingredients.
Yeah, but it just clicks.
The technique's all done.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And now that you are sober, how are you managing your stress and are you finding sort of other avenues?
I just work.
Workaholic.
No, I mean, I've done a lot of stuff, you know. I've tried meditating.
Yeah.
Wasn't really for me. I work out a lot and I go through stages. But I know I should be working out every day. It's really good for my mental health.
Yeah.
Just being active for an hour every morning is really, really good for my mental health. So I do that as much as I can.
Yeah, the boys tell me you like to rip in at Revel.
Yeah, yeah, I have a crack.
You have a crack. Yeah, because that's sort of been my journey too, is just trying to find something that you sort of connect with that's going to like help with that stress. And mine's working out too.
Yeah.
I need it.
Yeah.
Something that I've actually fallen in love with. I used to hate when I was playing footy, but now I do a lot of ice baths.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Like that sort of helps me sort of concentrate because it's so uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So when I get in there, I'm just trying to like not think about how shit this is and try to enjoy it. And like you said before, is enjoy the hard things, the things that you don't like.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's, I mean, I just also, I'm a bit of a lad too, right? Like, so I like motorbikes and...
Oh, do you?
Yeah, remote control planes and stuff like that.
Sick.
Yeah.
I was going to... Oh, that was one of the things I was going to ask you was do you have hobbies outside of cooking?
Yeah. I don't have any hobbies that I'm, like, obsessed over.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I do a little bit of kite surfing. I like riding my motorbike.
Yeah.
I like flying my remote control plane. Like, just boy stuff.
Just boy stuff. Where do you fly the plane around here?
I'll just go to a local footy park.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. Everyone's like, you should join a club. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. It sounds a bit
nerdy, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
I don't know. I can just go to a park and just have a play.
Yeah. What's been your biggest learnings as a head chef and managing people? Like effective communication. I'm sure you're good at problem solving.
Yeah. You've got to kind of be the everything. You've got to do everything. From counsellor to plumber to... You know, to everything, it's like, I think, any management role. But yeah, and everyone's different, you know, like you need to figure out how to communicate with people. Some people get, you know, want to have that communication in so many different ways.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and you've just got to learn how to how to kind of is best suited for that person.
How do you create a positive culture in the kitchen and a team to work with? How do you build that team?
Yeah, I think it's just more of the same. It's more of being aware of these people, and you know, when they're having on days and off days, and how hard you can push them.
And
just creating an open kind of environment where people feel like they're doing something for a bigger cause or a higher cause, and not like in a spiritual way, but in like they're part of something
moving forward. And I think that's what everyone sort of feels like. They want to be part of something and feel included. I mentioned at the start of the show that you wouldn't have got here without a lot of hard work. What did hard work look like for you in those early years in London? Was it first one in, last one out? What was hard work for you?
I've a little bit of that, but it's more so just showing up and being prepared to work when you're expected to. I think, you know, back then you'd do three doubles a day and two single shifts, so doubles 14, 16 hours, a single's 10 hours. You know, so you're doing huge hours. So it's just showing up and putting in graft. Like, actually, when you're at work, you're at work. You're not distracted by your phone. You're not distracted by what your girlfriend said to you before you left, or the argument you've had, or, you know, you're worried about your sick dog. It's like,
you leave it at the door.
You leave it at the door, you're at work, and you focus on work.
Yeah, I love that.
I think a lot of people struggle with that still to this day.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And something that I'm really interested in is, how challenging is it to keep being creative and innovative in the kitchen, like especially in London, like such a competitive market, and also keep that consistency?
Yeah, it's incredibly challenging. But I think the job I'm in now is more challenging for that.
Is it?
Well, yeah, because there's just make, if you do a menu for a restaurant, it changes four times a year, and then you might do, you know, specials, you know, once or twice a week.
But you've got 365 dishes.
I've got a lot of videos to make.
That is challenging. Yeah, so back to Melbourne, COVID hit,
yeah. Wow, what a time.
How was the time? Because obviously I was telling you before, my cousin's down there, and I asked him, he's in the food industry as well, and I asked him how bad was it, and he just shook his head and didn't say anything. And I was like, oh, fuck, it must be. Yeah. It must have been pretty bad. Well, obviously up here it wasn't.
No, it was
not
brutal.
To rub it in, but.
No, well, I came straight away. It was brutal. I was working, a corporate job for, you know, Emirates. So I was running all their restaurants in Australia and New Zealand at the airports. Caitlin, my partner, had a big contract with the Specsavers. You know, we were both pretty happy. You know, life was good. We were on, you know, about to buy a house, all the rest of it, right? And it happened, and I could see it was going to be huge. And I kind of kept trying to tell people and
warn people.
And no one kind of understood the grasp. And then really quickly it was like, okay, you know, I was the senior leadership team, so there was like seven of us on that team of big business. And it was like, right, let's batten down the hatches, you know, what are we going to do? And we had to let go of all of our casual staff. You know, there was like 1,600 of them.
Wow.
You know, and it was those conversations are incredibly tough.
Yeah.
You know, these are all Nepalese and Filipino kids on student visas. There was no support for them, you know, and all of a sudden it was like they just didn't have any money coming in. So dealing with that was tricky. And then it was pretty clear and pretty obvious that, you know, our jobs were at risk pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, my boss at the time, Justin, did a great job of navigating through that. And, you know, he kind of came to me and said, do you want to go part-time or do you want a redundancy? And I just took the redundancy and ran.
Yeah.
And there was no hard feelings on anyone. It was no one's fault. It was the way the world was, right?
It is what it is, yeah.
But I think that was what made it tougher to kind of process, you know. And I remember just thinking, what the fuck are we going to do? Like, there was no chance I was getting a job in Melbourne. There was no chance Caitlin was probably going to get a job at that time.
Was it tougher as in you didn't do anything wrong and you've just lost your...
Lost
your job.
Yeah. And not only that, it wasn't like... It was a scary time, right? Mm. Like, the media just did an appalling job, or a great job, I guess, depending on what, of scaremongering people.
Yeah.
It was wild, right? Yeah. Like, it was just...
Curfews.
And, you know, and everyone just freaked out, right? And so, all of a sudden, you're stuck in your Melbourne apartment that, you know, is great when you are spending 100 hours a week out of the house. Yeah. But you're stuck in there with each other.
Yeah. Was it for 8 months? Was it the longest one or something?
It was in Mel. We bailed real quick. So we made that decision. We're not getting your jobs. Pack the cars. We're out.
Oh, nice.
So we just drove up here.
Yeah.
That's why we moved to the Sunny Coast.
Oh, right. Yeah. So is Caitlin from the Sunny Coast?
Yeah, mate. Yeah, yeah.
So when you're telling all these workers to pretty much you don't have a job anymore, did that get to you emotionally, did it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, unluckily for the people who looked after operations, it kind of went over to them and it was kind of more their role to do it. But it did affect me, yeah. Mm. Yeah, it wasn't... You know, because it's the same thing as what you were going through yourself. Is that there's nothing you can do. Mm. Like it was, because we were owned. You know, Emirates was owned by another foreign government. We weren't. You know, the company wasn't entitled to any handouts.
Fuck.
There was no money. There's nothing, right? So it's a business that's gone from doing millions of dollars a day to just nothing overnight. Nothing. And you know, the Emirati government wasn't going to pay everyone's salary just for no reason. So,
do you think Melbourne's still struggling in the food scene? I don't know if you. Been back there and spent a bit of time back there.
I have. I've been back a lot. And that's kind of why I was talking about earlier about Sydney. And I genuinely mean it. I think Sydney has bounced back a lot faster and now is, you know, just as good, if not slightly better than the Melbourne food scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think Melbourne's really struggled to get back to where it was.
Since that COVID time, yeah.
And before COVID, Melbourne was without a doubt the best city for food in this part of the world. Like, without a doubt.
Yeah.
But now I think, you know, Sydney's kind of... seems to have brushed themselves off quicker. And that's not taking anything away from Melbourne because they had it tough there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really tough, yeah.
Yeah, probably didn't get handled right by the politics.
No, I don't think it did, but, you know, it's not my place to say.
This isn't a political podcast.
No. But it's the same thing that we dealt with. You know, the Melbourne food scene is run, it's not run by head chefs and it's run by workers, right?
Mm.
So we burnt a lot of those people, you know, and they went home to wherever their homes are around the world and they never came back.
Yeah, they wouldn't come back,
no,
would they?
No. And you know, those are the unsung heroes of that industry. It's the people that are in there doing the prep chefs and the guys on the line cooking the food, actually cooking the food, the guys doing the dishes, you know, the guys and girls, whoever, just like running tables, you know, all that stuff, cleaning the places, you know.
Yeah, brutal. So you mentioned that you packed the bags.
Yeah.
Made it to Sunny Coast.
Yeah.
what was the next step? You started making content.
I didn't do much, mate, to be honest. I kind of was a bit shell-shocked. And we were really lucky that Caitlin's parents live here and we just moved in with them and we didn't really have a plan.
Yeah.
It was like, all right, well, let's just go up there and see what happens. I kind of just cruised around for 6 months and didn't do much. Went camping a lot.
Did you?
Yeah, which is pretty cool.
Where's your camping spot? Is there a...
I mean, we were going up to DI all the time.
Oh, nice.
And it was before DI was ruined now. I don't even go there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just disgusting. but we went to Fraser Island in September 2020, maybe. And with two other couples, good friends of mine, actually Mitch and Daz, who are now part of my team.
Basic Mitch.
And then a good friends of ours, Tim and Zoe. And we were on Fraser Island, and there was no one else there. It was
crazy.
Right? Like, it was the best trip ever. There was no one there.
Yeah, you wouldn't get that now.
No, I think it's back to normal now. But we did that for 6 months, and then I did a bit of consulting off and on, and then I kind of started the content.
Did you need a sort of a break just to refresh and sort of pick sort of where you wanted to land?
Absolutely. And I've done that a couple of times in life, and I'm a pretty big advocate for it if you can do it. I think a hard reset's often pretty good, you know. And I had one, you know, kind of not by accident, but forced upon me when I went through rehab.
Yep.
And then I had the other one just kind of at the start of COVID, and I consciously was like, you know, did the maths and it's like, all right, we've got enough money to kind of last this long.
Yeah.
You know, we're lucky. We live with family and all that, you know, really blessed to have a lot of those opportunities. And it was just like, all right, cool. Well, let's not just stress. Let's just...
try to enjoy ourselves a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And just think, you know, like just think for a few months, which is, you know.
And you thought?
I thought a lot.
And then you landed with...
And then Andy Cooks comes along.
So how did that come along? Did it... come to you one day, we thought, I wouldn't mind getting in front of the camera? And
yeah, it started, there was a few things. We started a hospitality marketing business kind of randomly, like teaching people how to market hospitality.
You and Caitlin.
Yeah. Well, mainly me. I kind of forced Caitlin in on it a bit, which was a complete disaster for so many reasons. Like, no one had money to spend on marketing at that time.
Yeah.
And then I did consultancy, and I thought I could kind of have a good crack at a consultancy business. I realized pretty quickly I didn't love it, you know, like dealing with customers and telling them how to fix places and they don't, you know, they don't do what you say, and then they complain that it's not, nothing's changed. It's like, well, no shit. And then the content thing came along. I kind of, you know, I was doing a lot of research about personal brands, and you know, and it was that realization. I listened to a podcast with, I think his name's Dave Frogarty, and another guy whose name escapes me, but and they were talking about how he'd kind of built this massive brand on the back of a personal brand that he built, and it kind of sparked my interest, and I thought, well, I know how to cook, yeah, let's have a crack. Yeah,
I guess the other part of it is talking in front of a camera.
Yeah, well, it's like a skill. It's
isn't it?
Yeah, it's not easy.
So it didn't come natural to you?
No, absolutely not.
I just thought, like, because you're a chef, you can teach people how to cook. Yeah. I thought just doing the exact same thing with a camera in front of you would just be...
There's so much more to it too. It's like figuring out algorithms and figuring out how to use a camera, figuring out how to edit. You know, I did it all by myself too. But like I kind of said at the start, I just go into stuff really hard. So I said, let's go. I'm going to make, you know, at the start, for the first 3 months, I made 2 videos every day for 3 months. And then I cut it down to 1.
Yeah.
And I think just through repetition, you just figure it out.
Yeah.
But it's
through failure and something that you're not afraid of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And just go, well, what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, exactly.
Because putting yourself out on the internet is a pretty scary thing to do.
Absolutely.
For the person with the bravest people in the world, it's scary, right? So
I'm still experiencing that. Even with the first season, it's still been very unnatural for me to talk in front of the camera. Yeah. I can talk, this is fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when I've got to go, if I have to look at that camera, if I have to look right there and say something, I don't know what happens. It just doesn't, it come natural to me at all.
Repetition, mate.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah, you just got to keep doing it.
You hear that?
Yeah.
So what's your ethos now as a chef, as Andy Cooks, and how different is it compared to when you were in London?
Well, I think I'm a lot less pretentious than I was when I was in London. My ethos now with the whole Andy Cooks brand is just real simple. It's to inspire people to cook better food at home. And cooking's not that hard. Let's kind of pull it back. It's really not that, if I can figure out how to do it, anyone can. And it's also just about having a crack and realizing that, like most things, if you're going to take cooking kind of seriously as a hobby, or even if you're just trying to make your weekly repertoire better, you're going to have failures, right? Like, shit's not going to always go to plan.
Yeah, so, exactly.
It's not the worst thing in the world.
Right? No, it isn't. And what's the, like, even when I fail in the kitchen, I still eat it.
It's usually edible.
Yeah, it's still easy. Yeah. It's not too bad. Even when it's burnt a little bit, I still eat it. And how was that transition from commercial kitchen to home kitchen? I've never been in a commercial kitchen before, but I'm sure there'd be a lot of differences.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Was it a bit of a struggle?
Yeah, that was kind of one of the things that I talked about a lot, right? And I think that chefs and home cooks are very different people. And it was like, at the start, it was all about me on my journey from being a chef to being a home cook. Because like most chefs, I notoriously never cooked at home. You know, I'd cook for like Christmas or, you know, like a birthday. But, you know, I just never did it. I never cooked at home.
So is that the myth? Because I've got friends who are chefs and they go, yeah, I don't cook at home.
I never cooked at home.
Oh, right.
Not interested. Because you just cook all day. Right?
So what do you do when you get home?
Uber Eats, mate.
Do you? Well,
I mean, in Melbourne,
it's the best. So much good option.
And it's not, you know, expensive. Yeah, right? You can go get a bowl of Luxa for $15, $16. It's almost cheaper than it is to buy the ingredients to make it. Yeah. So,
And that's another thing I heard. I got a friend who's who's a chef at 150 at Alex there.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, I love it when I don't have to cook my food. Yeah. If someone else can just cook their food for me. Like, is that the same? Like,
absolutely. Yeah. And people go, oh, really nervous cooking for you. I'm like, I don't care. Yeah. Like, you can give serve me anything. I don't care. The fact that someone's cooked for me.
Well, come round.
Yeah, yeah. I've got you're on.
So I do this thing with Jordan. So when I'm away at work for the week, her job is to pick 3 recipes out.
Nice.
And then I have to cook them when I get back.
Nice.
Because I don't like choosing. So if she goes, all right, I want the corn fritters.
Yeah, yeah.
I want those burgers.
Yeah.
And I think we made, I think it was Babe's lemon olive oil cake.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, we, yeah. So every time I come back, we'll make 3 of those dishes. So that's why. Nice. That's my game that I like to play. So another thing that me and Jordan went to Europe last year. We got engaged over in Europe.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thought we'll mention Jordan on here. And something that really stood out for me, and that was my first time over to Europe, going to these countries, and 2 countries that really stood out for me was Italy and France. Mm-hmm. And I learned for the very first time about food culture. You know, it was such a shock to understand fully that, you know, the meals and that these countries have been cooking, they've been cooking them for, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Centuries.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, the recipe hasn't changed a whole lot. Like, they're so, like, adamant about their recipe being.
Yeah.
And, you know, I felt like this food was celebrated and almost, like, sacred.
Yep.
Do you feel like that's something that's helped your success in Australia here, is introducing people to sort of new foods and new ways of cooking, but also opened you up to criticism from these countries overseas?
Absolutely.
Has it?
Yeah. It's you nailed it, right? So Australia and New Zealand and England and the US even, they do not understand food culture. You know, if you go, there's like some countries that just, it's just everything. It's their whole identity.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's Italy, France, yes, but probably not cooked, not so much as Italy. Italy's like through and through. Spain, India, you know, and then a lot of the Southeast Asian countries, Thailand, Vietnam. You know, it's just everything. Yeah. Food is everything. Yeah. So you open yourself up to a lot of criticism when you're a white guy cooking food from any of those countries, because you're going to hear about it if you've got it wrong.
Yeah.
But I think for the most part, I think one of the reasons I am successful is because I have a crack and I get it right most of the time.
Mm.
Now, the other thing to think about is that it's also different from village to village.
Yes.
Right. So you talk about like a lasagna, one nonna will make it differently to another nonna, right? So you're never going to please anyone.
And every nonna's right, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. You're never going to please anyone.
So yeah.
You just got to remember that.
Yeah, when I was in Rome, me and Jordan did a cooking class.
Cool.
With this well-known chef. And before he had the cooking class, he had his own restaurant, a little side hustle of the cooking class.
Yeah.
And then a girl put up a TikTok video of doing the cooking class with him.
Yeah.
Went viral.
Yeah.
Within months, he shut down his restaurant.
He's just doing the classes.
Yeah. And he's turned his whole restaurant into a cooking class. Does it surprise you the incredible amount of reach the internet has and how quickly it can change your life?
It blows my mind every day still, you know. And you look at some of the numbers, you know, and it's just crazy. It's just wild, right?
Yeah. Like,
and it's just me from my kitchen in the sunny coast. And you know, there's millions of people.
Hundreds of millions
of people, you know. You know, we've done 2.5 billion views or something on YouTube. You know, it's wild. So
it's the whole country of China and India. Seen your videos.
Yeah.
And when I was in the class, we all sat down. I'm sure you've been to cooking classes before. You sit down with everyone and you sort of have a meal together. And I was asking the chef, I was like, oh, do you miss sort of not cooking in the kitchen? Like, this is me coming from a competitive rugby background. I was like, surely you miss sort of competing with the other restaurants. And he was like, fuck no. Yeah. Like, I sit down with 10 people from all around the world 3 times a day. I teach pasta. He goes, I teach pasta. I eat pasta 3 times a day. He goes, I love this. Like, yeah. I think he was saying that the pressure and what we were talking about before, the stress of being a head chef and running your restaurant comes at a cost. And he was like, I love what I do.
Yeah.
Can you relate to that and what you're doing now?
Absolutely. Mm. You know, it's you know, I have so much more influence now. In a positive way than I did when I was just running a restaurant or even running 100 restaurants. Mm. You know, like you can really kind of, you know, and the Philippines is a great example of that, right? Like another, you know, food obsessed country, and you start cooking Filipino food and the joy it brings the locals. They're like, thank you for telling the world about, you know, our food, you know. So,
well, my partner's Filipino.
She gets it.
Yeah, she gets it. Her mum gets it too. Yeah. She's, well, like, it's taken me a while to get used to the...
Yeah, it's, Filipino food's really interesting.
It is interesting.
It's very different to the rest of Southeast Asia.
It's a lot of chili.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't grow up in chili.
Yeah, yeah.
So, is this hot for you, mister? And I was like, yeah, it is. Yeah.
There's also parts of the Philippines that have no chili at all.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really regional.
Yeah.
You know, lots of Spanish influence because, you know, the Spanish trade that went through there. Mm. And, you know, and in some parts, you know, almost feels like it's Mexican food. Like,
yeah, it does.
Yeah, it's crazy. But
have you worked out, I've been trying to work it out, humans' weird fascination with watching people cook.
Yeah.
you know, like cooking videos and TV shows are like the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know what it is. Is what's that mukbang that people like?
That's just weird.
Watching people eat.
Watching people eat. It's a strange one.
Do you what content do you consume? What do you watch people cook?
Yeah.
Anything like that? What are your things?
I do now. I did really historically kind of how I ended up doing it. You know, it was that kind of a, you know, sideline ref. I can do better than that. Sort of thing. Yeah. But I enjoy now probably some of the more, there's a guy called Alex French who cooks, really like his content. He's not a chef by trade, but he kind of deep dives into dishes, and I kind of enjoy that content.
Yeah, yeah.
Joshua Wiseman, who, you know, is actually now just a good mate of mine. Mm. You know, I really enjoy his content, so I kind of have to say that.
Yeah. Give him a plug.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone who another person that I like is Notorious Foodie.
Yeah. He's a good guy.
He's a good one as well. I get it. There's three things that I get hooked on on the internet. It's nothing R-rated, so no kinks or anything. Well, it could be. Yeah. So cooking.
Feet pics.
toes. <Yeah. laughs> So it's, so it's cooking, watching people cut lawn.
Yeah, yeah. You're one of those ones.
Yeah, yeah, and car detailing.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I could sit there all day and I'll go Annie Cooks and then I'll go Tim the Lawnmower Man.
Yeah, Tim, he's a good guy. Yeah.
You don't know him though, do you?
I don't know him.
Oh, I thought they'd hold this. Yeah. Everyone's in the scene together. Make a little collab. Yeah, so there's a few reasons why I think you'll become successful and... Okay. I want to get your thoughts on them. And it's firstly, it's the little things you do in your videos. In this world of social media where everything's made to perfection, it's all, everything's done, has to be perfect. I think you stand out because of your imperfections.
Yeah, yeah.
I've noticed some of your videos, you're dropping the lid into your mix or sometimes you're burning food or... Yeah. I watched one this morning where you were making Yorkshire pudding.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you remember this? Yeah, the cut was too small. You're making a mess and you're tipping it back out. This would have been years ago when you'd done that. And I think you stand up because of your imperfections and you could have easily just like edited that out and started again.
Yeah.
But you decided to keep them in and I think that's helped you because you've taken yourself off this pedestal of fine dining head chef and you're now, you know, the home cook like the rest of us.
Yeah.
Was that a conscious effort? Did you mean to do that?
I don't think it was conscious. I'm just really passionate about being authentic.
Mm.
You know, and it sounds like a weird thing to say.
Well, we're going to be talking about that next.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it, right?
Yeah.
I think if every video you put out is, you know, there's not, you know, some element of humanization in there, I think you get lost pretty quickly.
Yeah. It's like a robot made it or something like that. And
yeah. Or it's really obvious that, you know, you just kind of do it. People just do retake.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean we don't do retakes. But those little incidents that happen that I think are funny, I really encourage, you know, I've always left them in.
Yeah.
So I think they're funny.
Yeah, they are.
More than anything.
But it stands out because when you watch other videos, it's like perfect. They've made that perfect.
Yeah.
Great, great, great. And it's got you in there and it's just like...
Yeah. And another reason why it came was also like showing my failures. At the start when I was posting a video every day, it was just me and I had a full-time job.
Mm.
You'd get to like 8 o'clock and I had a schedule. I'd post at 9 p.m. every night, right?
So I'd get to 8 o'clock. It's changed though.
It's changed. It's 8 o'clock now.
Daylight savings? Is it? Yeah, I thought so. Yeah.
So... I'll talk about strategy and stuff later, but you get to 8 o'clock and you film this video all day and
You're like, well, it's the only video I've got.
I have to use it.
Yeah. Right? Like, there's no, you know, like, there's no reshooting now. I've got an hour to get it up.
Yeah. And the other thing that you've already touched on is you being authentically yourself is another reason people are drawn to your content. I think you make people feel a certain way. And that's why I got here. That's why at 8 o'clock, it was, you know, it's now, you know, it was 8 o'clock now.
Yeah.
That all my friends and family, they tune into your videos.
Yeah.
Yet you make them feel, including myself, that we're capable of cooking these dishes. And I think maybe in the past we've been brainwashed to thinking that cooking is too expensive or takes too long or it's just unachievable.
Mm.
But what you've done is you've brought people back to the kitchen and you've given people the belief that, you know, I'm capable of cooking these dishes.
Yeah, thank you. That's the goal.
Mm.
You know, it's like is to inspire people to try different things.
Yeah. And not be afraid of your failures. I think that, especially with cooking, it's like,
it's gonna happen.
Yeah, but just have fun with it.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about strategies?
Yeah,
because that's another thing that
it's a big thing on my mind at the moment.
Is it?
Yeah.
So is it self-taught?
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
Just through trial and error.
Trial and error. Just a lot of research. Just a lot of cruising around the internet and reading what other people do. But so my theory's always been like post every day. Mm. You know, it was always 9 o'clock and then 8 p.m. daylight savings time. The reason we posted that time is because everyone here is going to sleep. Everyone in the US or even Europe are kind of waking up. You want to get people while they're flicking.
Mm. At the prime times.
In bed. But we're cutting down the videos this year. So we're still posting. We're going to post every other day. And we will still post to YouTube every Sunday. We'll do that. We do a few more sprinkled in just for good luck throughout the year as well.
Yeah.
But it's time for us, I think, to kind of slow down. And because I think I'm happy to run at 100 miles an hour all the time.
Mm.
But I feel like it's probably harder to find people that will
do
keep up with you.
Mm.
So I kind of rinsed the team last year. And they worked really hard and did a great job. But I think for longevity and sustainability in this industry, I think we're going to pull it back. But it's made me really nervous. And
has it?
Yeah. I'm not used to not posting every day.
Yeah. We'll wonder. See how it's going to go.
We'll see.
The team might get a kick up from the ass. We might start again.
The team might double. And then
Mitch! No more basic Mitch.
Let's go. We're back.
We're back.
We'll see how the numbers go. You know, the goal was to keep the same numbers that we have at post half the amount, which means we're just going to make better videos.
Mm. And that's always the challenge, isn't it? I guess an exciting challenge is how do I keep the audience engaged, but sort of not change the content, but sort of...
You've got to attract a new audience too. Because people always drop off. You know, people don't talk about this often in social media.
Oh, right.
I'll get 2,000 unfollows from Instagram a day.
Do you?
Yeah. But we'll get 10 or 12 or 20,000 new followers, right?
Yeah.
But you've got to stay on that wheel, right? Because as soon as those numbers start flipping, you're going backwards.
You're going backwards,
You've got to kind of keep reinventing yourself, keeping your audience that you've got, trying to attract a new audience and trying to keep people engaged. But I'm also really passionate about only making and producing videos that I like. I think as soon as you start making videos that... that you're just doing for retention or for attention, I should even say.
Yeah.
It's usually a downward spiral.
I'm so happy you mentioned that because it's something that I really struggle with doing this is not so much this season. I think I found more of myself and what I want to do in this second season. But the first season, I caught myself wanting to get guests in that I think the audience would like and not necessarily people that I actually want to have conversations with.
Yeah.
And it was a struggle because I was always putting the audience first. Like, how do I get views or how do I get people watching or how do I get engagement?
Yeah.
And I think I went away of why I started this in the first place.
Yeah.
And this second season, it's more so I'm only getting people in that I genuinely want to get to know and having conversations with.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's like what you said. It's, I think when you do it for that genuine fact, it will show on your content.
100%. As soon as you start doing, and it's the same with, you know, there's no
bet, like, you know, hiding behind it. Our business model is run from brand deals, right? But we're luckily now in a position like, I won't take a brand deal I don't want to talk about. You know, I just won't do it. And we also want full creative control. I'm like, if they're like, we want you to say this line at this point, this line, I'm like, nah, don't worry about
see
it.
See you later.
Yeah, I don't need it.
Yeah. Don't bribe me.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't bribe me, Woolies.
But it's so transparent, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, whereas I think in a really good brand integration is actually... It's still providing value for the customer, which is my audience, and it's still providing, you know, education around it, and it's a good product, something that you're happy that you would use.
Yeah, absolutely, like that oven you got from Bunnings.
I mean, there's a Gosney's that I do a lot of work with.
Nice.
Yeah,
I looked at that one. I tried to buy it.
Yeah.
Wasn't there.
Sold out.
Sold out. The power of Andy. I mentioned. For me, like, cooking is such a zen thing for me, and you know, I put on a little bit of John Mayer when I cook.
That's my jam. Yeah.
And I listen to a lot of his stuff and a lot of his content, and he said something that was really interesting to me. He said, it's such a different but way better feeling playing music to people who aren't musicians.
Yeah.
He said, musicians are always asking you about the chords you're playing, but people who aren't musicians are telling you how the music made them feel. Do you get a similar feeling or experience when you cook food for people who aren't chefs?
Yeah, I've never really thought about it. But yeah, I think chefs hyper-analyze everything and they find all the little imperfections really quickly. Whereas someone who's not a chef will just appreciate that it's more about the feeling that you've given them by having... It's the same as me. It's like there's nothing better than having something cooked for you, is it?
Yeah, and it's that power, I think, of food, is like that deep connection that we have with it. It brings up memories.
Yeah.
I think some of my favorite videos of yours... And I've thought about why have I saved it? Why there's 10,000 replays on it? It's because it's the same meal my dad used to cook me, or it's the same meal I had when I was growing up, or it's, you know, it brings you back to a time in your life, one of your favorite memories, or a painful memory that you sort of hold on to. That it's a bit wild, isn't it?
Powerful.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Where am I up to? The future of Andy Cooks.
Oh, the future.
What's the ceiling? Like, obviously...
There is no ceiling.
Obviously, we've got the cookbook.
Yeah.
Thanks
for the plug.
That's all right. What's the ceiling for you? What's... in my mind, like, I'm picturing... I don't want to give anything away, but I'm picturing, you know, TV show, you know, something that I love on Netflix. I watch Roy Choi and... I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah,
so I'm picturing, like, that's... Down your alleyway.
Yeah, certainly on the cards. Yeah, certainly kind of in conversations and stuff, but nothing's kind of set in stone at all or far from it. The media landscape's changing rapidly, and I think it's just as powerful to have, you know, a YouTube channel with as many followers as we have now as it is to have a show on a major network. So we will take a deal if we have one that makes sense, but the bread and butter and the goal and the... What we will continue to do is the YouTube and the short form content, that will kind of be the main focus for the foreseeable future. But people always, your success, and I'm one of these people that still doesn't think he's successful.
So. Don't you?
No, I don't think I ever will.
No,
I don't think that's kind
of. I think that will just keep the drive though, won't it?
Yeah, it keeps you going.
Yeah.
So I think as soon as you kind of start claiming that you're successful, it's probably the beginning of the end. So.
And one thing that's quite interesting is how you capitalize on your momentum.
Yeah.
So I don't know if, you know, when you've got this sort of rolling, you sort of bring out a cookbook and then you do all those, what's the little things you gave me with the cookbook?
Oh, dough colors. Yeah.
You know, you brought all those out. Is that a, you know, an effort that you're sort of always thinking about, is capitalizing on this momentum that you've created?
Yeah, I don't think, I probably wouldn't think of it as capitalizing. I think more of it as providing more value.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think we, you know, we'll, you know, we've got a whole bunch of merch working at the moment. I could have launched merch really quickly, but I wanted to do it, you know, a bit slower and make sure it's right and make sure it's actually providing value, as opposed to just kind of printing Andy Cooks on a t-shirt. And,
yeah.
You know, because you could do that and sell 100,000 of them, whatever. And you'll make a bit of cash pretty quickly, but I don't think there's much longevity in that. So it's just being really strategic now, because once you get to a certain point, the amount of opportunities get thrown your way is ridiculous.
It's hard to say no.
You just have to say no to everything. That's my all I do now is just say no, and then the stuff that keeps coming back or that I actually sparks my interest, I'll think about it more and
play the long game.
Play the long game. Yeah. We're in it for the long haul. We're not just churn and burn this. So.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Now, I thought we might give a plug.
Yeah.
A lot of people know her as Babe. And some of us know her as Caitlin, your beautiful partner. Yep. If you're happy to, can you share with us the impact that she's had on you? I know that she's been with you through the highs, but I think more importantly, she's been with you through the lows.
She has. So she was probably the caveat for my recovery from addiction, and I kind of was like, oh, I'm going to lose her if I don't do this.
Yeah.
And she didn't budge. She was like a rock. She was right there for me, supported me all the way through that. Mm. Incredible woman for doing that. Mm. And then she's always supported me, all my crazy ideas and even 3 or 4 businesses I've started that have been massive failures. She's never blinked. She just kind of says yes and nods and lets me do my thing.
Yeah.
And then now this kind of come along and almost, maybe not a year ago, but pretty pushing a year now, she's been on board full time and is kind of the brains of the whole thing now.
And I've been dealing a lot with her behind the scenes.
She's the one you got to get through to get to me now.
Yeah, I peppered her for a year. Yeah. Don't you worry. Surprised she didn't block my email.
So she's really smart. She's really, she comes from a marketing and comms background. So she deals with all the brands, she deals with all the requests, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it really frees me up to focus on the creative and focus on the cooking.
Do what you do best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's great because I can't do that stuff. Yeah. Shit. So,
So we got 4 quick fire questions to finish.
Yeah, yeah.
Your 3 non-negotiables for living a healthy and full life.
Ooh, exercise every day, do what you love, say no, and just don't take shit for granted.
Nice.
Yeah.
Who's your hero?
Oh, good question. I don't know. I look up to a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. I think in what I do right now, and it's really cliche, but I think Gordon Ramsay's is kind of the goat of celebrity chefs, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
You know, he's on all the social media platforms and does really well. You know, really successful YouTube series, really successful on all the major networks. So in my kind of genre, I think he's the one to kind of beat and the one I'll be going after.
I like to see a little cook off with you and fucking Gordon. You'll have to you have to swear at him though, wouldn't you?
Yeah. No. Just be me, mate. He can do what he wants.
If you could go back to one moment in your life, where would you go and why?
Probably before COVID, we were in Bali, and we had a beach club called Sundays, I think it's called. We were there for our friend's wedding, Jesse and Caitlin, and it was after the wedding, and it was like a lot of people had gone home, and I don't know, it was just this like really incredible day that you were on this we're on this white sand beach, there was the food was all right, it was pretty good, the weather was amazing, the company was good, and I don't know, it was just a really cool day.
Yeah,
I remember that forever.
Nice. Yeah. A piece of advice that you would give 21-year-old Andy starting out this journey, what would you tell him?
Just be yourself.
Be yourself.
Yeah, it's the hardest thing to do, but it's the most important.
Yeah, love that. And just to finish off, something that I just wanted to tell you, when we did this book signing, you probably don't remember what you said to me, but I asked you how you were going and you looked down and you were like, I'm actually pretty overwhelmed. And I said, why? In my head, I'm like, why? You're the man. And you said, I just didn't think this many people would come out. And later that night, Jordan was like, what was it like meeting Andy? Because she's in bed, she says goodnight, and I'm there on my phone going, where's this next video? Like, can't wait to watch it. So she's always watching me the last couple of years saying goodnight to Andy after I say goodnight to Jordan. And I was a little bit confused of how I felt after meeting you. Initially, I thought it was envy or jealousy because I seen how you started this from absolute nothing. Like, you weren't had any sort of social media platform at all, and then you've built it from the ground up, and then sort of meeting you and hearing your story, and then I felt like I was just really jealous that you've created this life from absolute nothing. And then the more I thought about it, it was probably a day later that it wasn't jealousy, it was inspiration. And you've inspired me because if, you know, not to put anything on you, but you're no different to any of us. No, like, if you can do it, I can do it. So absolutely. I just wanted to let you know that you've inspired me on my own journey.
Awesome. Thank you, brother.
I've also got a little closing tradition for you. So my closing tradition is that I don't ask the last question.
Okay.
I get a loved one, whether it be a family member, a friend.
Cool.
They send in questions for the guests.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's get it, Kristen.
Great. Just wanted to drop you a quick question, brother, for your podcast today, around focus and separating work from not work time. How do you manage having such an intense busy day and busy schedule and managing your time away from work? Obviously, it can be a battle for a lot of hospital people with such pressure and such hours to switch off. So I just wondered if you had any tips or tricks to separate work and not work. Love you very much, brother, and can't wait to see you in a couple of weeks. Peace.
Sammy Sweetheart, he is one of the greatest human beings of all time.
Is he?
Yeah, he's a legend.
Good friend?
Yeah, really good friend.
Yeah.
I'm the worst person to answer this question. Because
no, you don't switch off.
I just don't switch off.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
And it's not, that's not helpful at all. I get that. But I think for me, the only is the gym. It's like, you know, I go to the gym every morning. It's the one thing I don't do with Caitlin. I don't do with anyone else in my life. And kind of also deliberately would never probably socialize with anyone from the gym either. Mm. And not because they're not good people, but just because it's like, that's the hour of Andy. There's Andy there, and there's nothing else. There's
that's your outlet.
There's no questions. And then that's it. I'm back. I'm on. But you know, who knows how long I can do that for? Yeah.
Great. I got one more for you, mate.
Okay.
You like this? So just press play.
Cool. Oh, babe.
Hey, babe. I have a little question for you. What advice would you give someone who is about to start a business with their significant other? How do they juggle building a successful business but still maintaining a healthy relationship?
Good question.
Convenient question, isn't it?
I think it's something that you really have to work at, and that we really work at pretty hard. But there's also something really special about building a business with your loved one.
I bet.
Yeah, because it's like, you know, I saw someone else talking about it as well. It was like, there's most relationships, you go off, you do your job, you come home, you eat dinner, you sit on the couch, you know, and you don't really talk. You kind of just, you just kind of are together. Whereas we have, there's always something to talk about with us, whether it's, you know, work or not work. But I think, you got to have really good communication. You have to be super open with each other. And, you know, to the point where if you're just a little bit angry, you have to be like, that pissed me off.
Have to air it out straight away.
You have to. Yeah. You can't hold grudges. You've got to be super, super honest.
Yeah. Beautiful. Andy.
Awesome.
Thanks very much for coming on today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And like I said, it's, you're on my bucket list. So
cool. Glad to tick that box for you.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Cheers, mate. Nice one.